Hi, this is Cindy Faye Solomon here with the Global Product Management Talk, again to discuss the ongoing development of the Lean Spec. You can follow me at Cindy F. Solomon, S-O-L-O-M-O-N, on Twitter and at startupproduct.com. I'm here with Malcolm of the Engineer Accelerator.
Hello.
And why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Malcolm Knapp, and I'm running the Engineer Accelerator. It's a professional training program for embedded systems and electrical engineers who are looking to transfer or start in the industry, so giving them the professional skills they need to be effective in their careers. And this is the Lean Spec is one of the things we go over in the course, and what I'm working on with Cindy is how does it translate from hardware side into the sort of product management and the software side?
And product managers and in software development, I've seen a number of different approaches at different points, but there's no standard process that everyone uses. And my intention is to educate new product managers and to forward product managers in their career to produce excellent results at every point of the product process, pre-development and post-development.
So what we're going to go, we talked about last time, we sort of did a little example of the process, sort of it's what you would do sort of in the kickoff meeting sort of phase. So what I wanted to do was go sort of dive down a little bit into that whole, what we're sort of, you know, what I was getting at with that, and then to sort of expand out from there to, you know, the whole process itself, and how do you actually sort of, you know, when do you know you've created a lean spec and when you're done, and move on to the build. So the key thing I wanted to sort of get at was this thing about specificity. I mean, if you listened to the last podcast, I kept on returning to, you know, these sort of other issues would come up, and those are all good, but the key thing was, and the thing I wanted to emphasize was that you're going for getting a specific set of either features or behaviors, so if you're talking about, you know, in your situation, the sort of onboarding process is one of the things we talked about. You can say there's going to be an onboarding process, but that's not very specific. It's like, well, what is the first screen they see? What is the second screen they see? What is the information on those screens? And to get down to that level of detail is, I feel, the necessary level to you have to be at that level. Otherwise, you can't really build to it, you know. And so in the end, it's sort of, this is where it starts looking like engineering. It's sort of looking like UX or that sort of stuff like that, is you are actually getting and making those sort of build decisions or engineering decisions about the flow of the user through the product or what information is on there, but you're just getting the sort of first level of information. You don't have to figure out what colors they're going to see at that moment. You just have to figure out, you know, what is the types of information that they need to get at.
And here's where I think that getting to this point has to be a similar process for a designer.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, as a hardware engineer, you're essentially designing what the product will look like, mm-hmm. as well as what the experience of using the product will be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, as a, you know, with my clients, is that's the situation I'm in a lot, is that I'm acting as the sort of sounding board or sort of asking about the user experience, because the client I have is the owner of the vision for that, and they're the ones who are, it's their decisions that ultimately lead to the user experience of the product. Now, in bigger companies, you have, this is split up into various people, but you can still have those people in the room at this moment. And the key thing is to know what types of information are at the highest level in the informational hierarchy. So, I mean, there's already sort of examples of this at certain levels, at least in sort of, you know, wireframes and things of that sort. I think there's an even higher level beyond, above a wireframe, which is just the list of like what the fields are that are important, you know, and you don't even know how they're going to be laid out, but that what information is going to be requested or asked for, displayed in any screen, for example, in a software product, is it really important to figure out, and it's the really the highest level. So, you know, I know that there was, you know, we just did a really short snapshot of what could easily be, you know, a 2-hour meeting. I've had like 6-hour meetings sometimes, depending on how big the group is, to go through this sort of stuff, to at least a sort of initial thing. But I wanted to sort of pick out a few things about that. And so what you basically do is you're trying to get to that sort of level of specificity, throughout the whole product. And so as we would sort of develop this forward, you know, we started out with just sort of describing some of the screens that we would see, some of the interfaces that you would have to have to external, like, you know, different webinar sort of systems, you know, how, you know, then there's a question of whether, you know, the behavior of, you know, are you going to their website? Are they importing, embedding their content in the app and so forth? And these, you have to sort of fill out the whole product and have a complete picture of it by the end of it. And so sort of what I wanted to do now was to take a sort of step back, and I'm actually very interested in your sort of view on this, because from what you've seen. So, you know, we'll take a step back and sort of look at the whole process, and you can sort of see how this maps over to what you've experienced in product, management and, you know, the process that you guys have gone through. So basically you start with a sort of kickoff meeting where it has to be sort of in the room, and you start by, I like starting with the product or the block diagram, which basically maps how all the different sort of features or the different like parts of the product relate to each other.
So it's essentially a flowchart.
Yeah.
Except usually a flowchart is used to depict software,
mm-hmm.
and what you're calling the block diagram, you're showing the hardware aspects mm-hmm. as well as the interactivity or the wiring. Mm-hmm. Internally.
Yeah, and so the thing is that this is actually used a lot in hardware for doing sort of signal processing descriptions and signal flow. And so it's used a lot there as well. It's a very, very general, sort of signals and systems is a very general modeling system that I think applies to lots of different areas. And so I think it applies, again, to websites or to software and, you know, all the sort of stuff like that. But this is one of the aspects of the lean spec, and we'll sort of talk about documentation in a moment, but the block diagram captures the connections and the flows between the various parts of the product. And so what you do there is then, you're trying to enumerate out all of the different blocks that are in a product, in a software product or a web product. It's the sort of the screens that the user will navigate through, but also like the databases that they'll be interfacing with. Like, you know, there'll be a server, and when does information go to the server and when does it come back, and, you know, what are the connections of that source? That's also part of the sort of the connections, you know.
So in your process, you're actually designing the user interface.
Well, so this is where you're designing the highest level of the user experience. So I would say that you do get to user interface stuff, but again, you're trying to do it at the highest level in the hierarchy. You know, the user is ultimately, you know, the person buying the product, and so having them in the room or having their, you know, as one of the first things you're dealing with, it's sort of one of the sort of fixed points in a project is who is going to be using it. I mean, I also think that a product manager can be can represent the user, you know, a lot of times, you know, have the vision for the product, but also be the person who is who's representing the user in the room when you're talking about technical things. You know, in some ways it's important, in some ways better that they don't know all the details of how it's technically going to work, because the user won't know those and the user won't care. And so,
right. And it's very hard for a product manager, anyone who's deeply involved with the product, to then have fresh eyes to come into those discussions not having any presuppositions.
Well, but just sort of to, you know, when I'm doing this, I'm always thinking about, you know, if I were a user, what would my experience be?
Right.
And so that's part of the discussion. So, you know, this is again, so then you generate this block diagram, And a lot of times, and then the next thing you talk about is what I sort of call behaviors, or the things that the sort of the sequences that the user your users or actions that will be taken by the user or by other sort of events that happen. You know, so if you can imagine a system that is getting data from a sensor, you know, network or something like that, it's going to receive data at certain points that there'll be these events. What does it do with that data? You can imagine the cellular system, cellular network is passing packets back and forth all the time. There's a protocol that it follows to do that. And with any product, there's a sort of similar sort of sequences of behavior or protocols that will happen for anything. So as we're talking about the webinar sort of app, there's the onboarding sequence, you know. And
I just want to say that's the intention of user stories, to really zero in on, as a user, I want to be able to do such and such. And those are what are used to inform what features do we need, and then also to help prioritize, well, what do we build when?
But this is, again, a key distinction. User stories, again, are from the user perspective. But that's the thing, is that a lot more can happen behind the scenes of a product than what the user sees.
Right.
And so you have to enumerate out those steps as well. You know, this talking about communicating to a server. I was in one product where it was a remote temperature sensoring for vaccine refrigerators. And what basically it did was it measured the temperature. If it goes out of range for too long, the vaccines are spoiled and you can't use them. So they wanted to get much better reporting of this because the powers would go out, people wouldn't notice, and they didn't know if the things were usable or not.
And
so what you had to do is that the user story is, we would like to know when the vaccines were bad or were not usable anymore. But the actual sequence was, you had the temperature sensor, and then if the temperature was out of range for more than an hour, you sent an SMS to the server, which would then take that information and then forward that on to a preset list of other sort of phone numbers who then get the information out. So the user story is good, but it's not the product.
Right.
You know, and the thing is that's just one way of doing it. That's one sequence you could possibly go through.
It's also important, and here's what the value is that I see, because I speak to so many inventors and founders. They haven't thought through all of the implications involved.
Yep.
So you're talking about building this block diagram that can include user stories, but it also is a vehicle for communicating and testing the assumptions.
So
did we include all of the different complex things beyond the idea?
Yeah, so the thing is that, and I should be clear about this, is that the block diagram is just capturing the flows of the sort of, you know, the features or the things that don't change with time. A lot of times it's hardware, but it can be, you know, screens of an app or that sort of stuff like that. And the behaviors are captured differently. The behaviors are captured, usually it's sort of like, you can think of it like pseudocode or a sort of list, basically just a list of steps, a sequence. And it's done in a text file, actually, and we'll talk about. And so this is something slightly different. You know, this is something you can list out. And you say, well, when someone presses the feature, this button on the screen, what is the sequence of events, or what is the sequence that happens after that? You know, and so this is one of those things that this is something that I think a lot of times is missed in these sort of discussions, is that people, you know, they look at the artifact and they think about what the visual or physical sort of aspect of it. But then there's this behavioral aspect, the sort of how the artifact changes and through time, that is, I think, a lot of times not enumerated through until way in the build, and then they would discover edge cases or logical situations, or even that sometimes you need a new feature to accommodate for those things.
And that's the other why I'm excited about teaching this process of thinking through, is because commitments would be made, and they would realize there was something was missed, but it's too late. They're already involved in building out those features And you can't backtrack because so many things are related.
Well, I think the thing is, and this I was going to get to this at the end, but just sort of is to say that this gives you a way, the lean spec gives you a way of controlling feature creep or this sort of question. It's a question of, well, we know we'll have to change. If we change what our lean spec is, that'll imply changing the time it takes to do it. We'll have to throw away work. We'll have to redo stuff. And this way, it gives you a way of characterizing what that is more than just saying, oh, it's going to be really a lot of work, or it's going to be a little bit of work, it's going to be easy, hard. You can actually have a better sense about that sort of stuff. So anyway, so to sort of get back into the sort of the process, you do this, and you do this for, you know, like I said, 2 hours, 3 hours, depending on the number of people, depending on the size of the product. You don't do it like, you know, for 3 days. You do it, and so, but you do it one meeting, and then the product manager or me goes away and puts it into the documentation format. I was mentioning this before. There's a block diagram, and there's a sort of text file, basically, sort of indented list text file that you can then, and you write, you sort of organize all the stuff that was talked about in the meeting. And then by organizing that, you automatically find pieces that are missing, unknown information. And you automatically mark that, and a lot of times I mark it in red or put question marks or something like that. But having to put it into a format and having to start writing the documentation right away, it means that the unknowns in the product and the unconsidered parts of it immediately start rising to the surface. Because what you're looking for is that for the block diagram, all the signals have a starting point and an ending point. And that for all the sequences, that every single event has a sequence associated with it, and that all the behaviors are synchronized with all the features, so they all match up, and those things come to the surface very quickly.
And here's where it's important that the product manager be working with the engineers.
Mm-hmm.
Even with domain experience, it's still the product manager should not be saying how it's built.
No.
And it's paralleling what a product requirements document, the intention of it, which was never, there were never standards on what has to be included in this product requirements document. It was just the onus was on the product manager to keep it a live document and update it appropriately.
Well, but, and this is the thing, is that the product manager doesn't have to know what those sort of red text or unknown parts are. They just have to know that there's nothing there right now. So they can say, go to the engineer or go to the UX person and say, here's an area I don't know what we're doing yet. What should we do there? Like, how do we figure it out? Like, and then they fall into their role of representing the vision of the product and the user, and sort of respond to what the engineers say, you know, and work it in, and then fill in the parts that are unknown. And the idea is that you would just go around the loop a couple of times. I mean, I do, you know, when I do this, it's been, you know, 3 to 5 times, you know. Sometimes it's quicker, sometimes it's slower, depending, again, on the size of the product. But the idea is that you write it up, and you see the unknowns, and then you go to the people who can fill in those unknowns, and then you make sure again, then you write it up again, and make sure that everything's synchronized again and all is complete again. And you keep on going around the loop until the amounts of unknowns, the amounts of red in your document have been reduced down to a sort of low level, basically.
And that's an ideal world, because I've worked with engineering teams who were all moving forward on what their vision was.
Mm.
And then it was up to me to tell the narrative to include all their different visions in one amalgamation.
Well,
and that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing, is that if people are running ahead, it means that, and going down to lower levels of the design or the build, then that means that they're fixing parts of the stuff that may not synchronize with other parts of the design.
Right.
You may have design conflicts. And so this is what you're trying to avoid. And so again, this is why this is pre-build.
Right.
This is something where the build is not kicked off yet. And
I just want to say, so many product managers will come to me and say, I'm failing. You know, as a product manager, I'm not doing it right because, you know, no one's listening to me,
yeah,
or I'm being blamed when these things aren't syncing across the different engineering teams, and I am constantly telling them, no, you're doing it right. This is the nature of the beast. However, you want to take hold of some level of communication to get everyone onto the same page.
And so the thing is that you can always, and this is where you can say, well, you can continue, you can move forward, but we have all these unknowns that are undefined, and so the risk of moving forward is that much higher.
Right.
And so it's again, if there are reasons to move forward, if the managers are willing to accept that risk, then they can. But it means this is a way of, you know, sort of qualitatively or sort of giving you a sense of how much risk you have, how much red or how much, you know, question marks you have in your product. That implies how much is left to figure out.
And that's where the product manager has to be really adept at asking the right questions, getting the right respect to get the information they need, and being forthright in communicating to everyone involved. What is going on here, what the vision is of this block diagram, so they see what they're not seeing, because the product manager is the only one who's seeing all the perspectives.
Yeah. And so this is doing, and so that's the translation part, and that's where this sort of, that's the work in some way. But so the idea is when you're doing this sort of iteration is that you're not trying to say, you're not saying here's how the product should be. But you are saying, here are the implications of what you've stated, you know. So that means that, again, it's you know, then it's up to the engineers or the UX people to make that decision. Now, and if there's a conflict, then you can say, we have a conflict where these things will not synchronize. And then you can go and have a process, then you sort of have to go to the sort of higher level in some way and say, how do we resolve this conflict? But you don't just sort of paper it over. You bring it to the surface and say, we can't move forward until this conflict is resolved, because we know it will cause problems later on. So the key thing is that you reduce down, you iterate through, and you will still have unknowns. Some things you don't know in the spec. There's some, you know, it's not perfect. The idea is that, you know, the classic sort of thing of doing a spec for months and months and months and months, you get it perfect, and then it's immediately no longer, you know, then things change. The idea is you're going to down a level until you reduce down the unknowns to a low level, to the level you accept or you agree on is low enough. And then you say, we're done. Because sometimes there's this information you need, you can only get into the build to answer. You basically say you will have unknowns left, but you agree as the team that they're acceptable, and then you freeze the lean spec. And what that means is that everybody in the team agrees that this is what we're building, you know. And a lot of actual engineering work has already been done. A lot of design work has already been done. But this is the agreement of what we're building. It's the features, it's the behaviors, it's the interfaces to the outside, other technology, other sort of systems. Those have all been figured out. And so you agree, and so then that freezes the design. And this has a lot of good implications, because then you have a starting point for the first example is controlling feature creep. If there's anything that's added in there that's not on the list, then you can actually, you can say, well, wait, this is not on the list. We have
to the backlog.
Well, it's then the point. So the decision is for the people, you know, if you were asked to add something in, you say, well, either we stop our work on the current product and figure out what the implications of the adding this in will be, or we add it to the backlog. So if you accept that we're going to stop work on the current thing it won't be too long to figure it out and integrate it in, but we have to go through this whole sort of definition or sort of specification process again. You accept that it's important enough, we will go do that.
And here's where the product manager has to be really managing not the build, but the features. Are we adding them? Is that new request aligned with what we've said the intention of the product is, the market opportunity, and everything else that got us here?
And it's also, So that's one thing that allows you to do. The other thing it allows you to do is now you have a list of, 20 features and, 30 behaviors or whatever it is. You have a list of 5 interfaces. That quantifies, gives you a sense of how complex your product is. And there is a way, what you can then do from that is you can then scope the rest of the product, project. Now we're in the project, not product, but the project, to implement that. And it will scale based on how many, how big, how much you're trying to do. So,
well, you also have finite parameters for you to determine, do you have the resources, budget, man hours to accomplish that?
Exactly. So you're given a budget, you're given time. Each feature, if you're talking about hardware, for example, if you're talking about a hardware feature, that implies tasks. And so for every feature, that implies that I have to source an integrated circuit for it, I have to make a symbol for it, I have to make do the schematic, do the layout for that part, I have to bring that part up, I have to test that part with all the other parts, and that's for one. So each feature implies a certain number of hours to implement it. And if you have 10, well, you just multiply things by 10. And so if someone's bringing in a new thing to add in, this is how you can sort of say, well, that's great. We get this much more performance, but it will cost this much more to implement that, and will take this much more time. Do you accept that? And so every time you don't get into, I was in a discussion one time where we did not do this. It was a thing. I was like, we need to make a lean spec for this product. And then they didn't do it. I sort of went on because and I sort of regret that decision because a little while later, it was a modular product. And there was, in the final thing, there'd be 20. But we said for our first, field trial, we're going to put 4 slots in there. And then the founder of the company said, well, it wouldn't be that hard. It's just a few more holes to have slots for 20 or slots for 10, I think it was actually. And I said, well, yeah, that's true. It's just a few more holes. And of course, what happened is that now there were slots for 10, now we ended up putting 10 in there, right? Which, meant I had, six more times cables and many more things to test, and because the cables were there, they didn't all fit because there was actually that much space, and that was a 15-second conversation.
Yeah.
And part of the reason why I couldn't say was that I didn't have a list of things saying, here's what we're doing and this is all we're doing, that you agreed to.
Right.
And so the key thing is that you get this agreement at the beginning so that...
But gun for hire, that's not your job. Your job is to deliver what your paycheck is paying you for.
Well, that's what I did.
Right, but that was a mistake.
But the thing is that it meant that the product was delayed.
Right.
And it meant that it didn't work as well as it could have.
Right.
And it meant that we had to work, many, 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 many hours to try and get there.
Right.
So if you're talking about managing and keeping, preventing burnout and all that sort of stuff like that, this is a way of controlling that.
Right. Based on data.
It's power saying, it's not power saying no, because you are not, as the product manager, you're not saying no. You're saying, here's the implications. It's your decision to say yes or no to that. And that's a very powerful...
Just know what the
but then they have to own that decision.
Exactly.
And then the next thing to say is that, well, we have this list of things. What you can then do...
And here it is, and you signed off on it.
Yeah. Here's your thing. Here, you'd signed off on this list. You thought this was great. We can change it, but you have to accept the implications
of
that.
And let me just remind you what it took to arrive at this.
Yes. Yeah. So, we want to sort of close things out. But so you've done this. You've done a scope for this. You now can get, I found that this is a much more accurate way of scoping things because it's dependent on what you are going to really build as opposed to, what you think you're going to build. And so it's based on the actual product itself as opposed to the phase, of like, well, you have architecture and we have design and we have, implementation and bring up and so... And those take, for this sort of project, well, it's, you know, a month or whatever it is. It's more, well, because we have, you know, 10 features and each of those features takes 3 hours or 10 hours, it's going to take, you know, the effort you have is, you know, you know, 100 hours of that, you know, and then that's much more granular. And so, and it gives you much more way of trading off features. I mean, when I've been doing this, as opposed to project's scope growing by a third, when you start, like the moment you start actually getting into it and you realize, oh, this is all the stuff we have to do, instead they drop by a third.
Oh,
they drop because they say, well, here's what we wanted to do, but we only have this budget and this schedule.
Right.
Let's cut out functionality that we can get, we don't have to deal with, that's we can live without.
I never met an engineer who wanted to do less of...
Well, the thing is that I want to have successful projects.
Right. You want to have completion.
And part of the whole thing is if things grow by a third, your scope and your budget, you know, were scoped for the original, for the sort of original size. And so if you things grow by a third the moment you start, you're already behind budget and you're already behind schedule and you're already in a situation where someone's going to be working 60 hours or 80 hours or whatever it is to catch up, and then things get more out of control. And so just to sort of finish up, so you have this list. So what do you, so how do you extend this? So you can scope from this, which is great. You can control feature creep, you control
We're
that.
We're talking about the text documentation
of
all those.
So yeah, so you have a text list of all the features, you know, you describe their characteristics and sort of stuff like that. You have a list of all the behaviors. Then what you can do is you can take that same list and you extend it into the build and say for each feature, you sort of, you know, you add a section that says implementation. And then you write out how you're going to actually do it. You know, this feature will be implemented with these, you know, ICs. It'll be this and that number of parts. You know, this is a, you know, a description of how it will be implemented. And then also a description of what is the acceptance test that passes that feature or not. Because one of the biggest things you get is you get a situation where people don't have a test for all the functionality. And if you don't have a test, you have no idea whether the product is actually functioning the way you want it to at all. You have nothing to compare it to. And so by thinking of the acceptance criteria right at the beginning, when you're thinking about the implementation of it, it means that you have something to test against when you actually built it. And you know at that moment what equipment you will need, because whenever you're doing a product, you know, you're not just making the product, you're making the test system to test the product as well.
In hardware
and in software. Test-driven development is all about building a test fixture for your software at the same time as you're building the software itself. And so by putting this at the very beginning of the build, or very beginning of the within the lean spec itself, this is the extension of the lean spec. So you have your list. It's self-contained, and then you can know. How are we doing on the architecture of our product? Well, how many of the features have been mapped, and how many of the behavior has been mapped down to actual things that are code or actual hardware or whatever it is? You know, this is where you do your your screens. How many of the screens have actually been mapped down into have been frameworked? Is it 5 of the 10? Well, then is it 9 of the 10?
Then you can use project management software very easily to track.
Yeah, so you can do it.
Your Gantt and
exactly,
your
but
roadmap.
You do it by what you are actually planning to implement versus doing it by some sort of much more amorphous sort of phase, or like, are you 20% done? Are you 30% done? Well, you know, this gives you a set of, this is the number of things
based
we have.
Based on actualities.
Based on much more specificity about what you're really going to build. And then once you get done with that, then you get that whole list done, then you have your sort of, your architecture is much, you've done this whole mapping, and then you have a really tight connection between here's what we wanted to do, the user stories, here's the product, the features and behaviors of the product that do that, and here's the implementations of those features and behavior in the build itself. You have really direct line between all those three things. And then if something changes, well, then you can really easily see the much more easily see the implications of that change. It's also the structure. You know, I've worked very hard on the structure of these documentation. I actually call it sort of fractal documentation because it's an indented list, a large, you know, there's a block diagram, there's an indented list that has the behaviors and feature characteristics in them. You can actually expand and collapse that list and add in and remove features and behaviors really easily. That it's a sort of cut and paste operations that allow you to sort of keep the document live and much easier to maintain than a lot of other systems, than anything else I've sort of seen out there.
It's a visual representation mm-hmm. of all of the things that go into the building of the product.
Yeah, and so, but at this very high, at this sort of the highest level in the hierarchy, for the informational hierarchy. So what you'll not see in there are, you know, for hardware, resistors and capacitors, and you know, in the product in the lean spec itself, you'll see. You'll see like regulators, and you know, see the words you will see are like regulator or like processor or you know welcome screen or something like that. You'll see very high level descriptions. You won't see like pixel widths or like specific code like syntax or any of that sort. So it's a structured document that's meant to be human readable. It's at the human level. It's not at the and so
it's not code.
It's not code, but it's formal and structured. And so you have to think about the product in a formal and structured way and fill it all together.
So does it become essentially a very complex checklist?
That's the thing, is then you can extract out from that checklist if you want to. You can extract out all the features and sort of see how many, you know, where you are with the sort of low-level implementation of each of those features, you know. What you can then use for the actual implementation, you can say how far are we done, how much more do we have to implement, and during testing you can then compare again how much has been tested, how much has been validated against the acceptance criteria, and how much is left to do. So.
And that's for the project manager.
So the project manager can sort of take it on, and sort of it can be extended into the build itself is the key thing. And then once you're done with that sort of that mapping, the lean spec is basically finished. You'll end up getting into things like code. That's when you start getting into code, and the format of the information changes. The documentation.
So the planning is done.
Yeah, and then you
now
start.
You
with the implementation section, you're getting into the build, but you're still putting that information into the lean spec. It's still in the same documentation set, basically. But then after that, after you've done and mapped all the features and behaviors, then you move into things that capture level of information better. Code captures information better in, you know, syntax and all that sort of caption, you know, is what you actually need to run things on computers. And CAD is something you need to actually make a physical, you know, case and printed circuit boards, you know, software is what you need to make printed circuit boards. So you then, that documentation becomes the sort of touchstone and where people can get information from, but it's sort of, it will not be updated as much because it's sort of the guide for the rest of the lower level implementation.
So in terms of if you were using a Kanban board, would the lean spec essentially be, here's all the to-be-dones?
Yeah, basically. It's a starting point for that. It's like, you know, and then you can sort of, it's that list, you know. You want to know all the things.
All the stickies.
it's you have this big list. And the key thing about this is that you can do this in a fixed amount of time. This is not something that grows and shrinks. It's that this can be done in a 2-week period or a 1-week period or whatever. It's just really dependent on your cycle speed. You know, this, every time you go through the iteration, the faster you can do that, the faster you can get it done. But for any product, the scaling is not exponential, whereas it's very linear and sort of sublinear, I would say. Because writing a new text box, writing a new box with a word inside or adding some lines to your, behavior list or, you know, sequence takes seconds, and removing them the same. Whereas recoding out, you know, functions can take hours or days, you know. So you can do this phase. I mean, this is what I do with my clients, is I, you know, for pretty much every client, you know, I have, depending, you know, I will, give them the product definition as a fixed bid, you know, here's how long it's going to take, here's how it's going to be flat. And then from there, I scope the rest of the product or the project. And then that's, then that's done on a sort of, you know, different basis. But it's all that, the source of that bigger scope, that bigger estimate, is the product definition or the lean spec.
So it's conceivable that in an organization, they would gain a discipline of using this effectively. So the first time everyone's learning how to use it, how to collaborate, how to communicate. After that, to do the next iteration of the product or to do a new variation, they have the process down.
Yeah.
Certainly the product manager has it down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm seeing the vision. If the product manager had this skill of utilizing this and bringing everyone through this process, it would increase not only their effectiveness, but the product results.
That's what I think, is that, you know, this gives you a framework to make decisions and also gives you a way of organizing the information so you don't, I mean, I've seen people, you know, products and projects where they forget features. They wrote them down or they had them in, they were in the list, in the discussions, and they were forgotten completely, you know.
Or if we're talking about hardware, sourcing the materials is going to affect the vision as well.
Yeah.
This idea that they want to use all these materials, and then they find they can't get them at the right price, or they can't get them in the way that they want them.
Yeah. So I think that, so, you know, if you can, when you are, you know, go through this process, it's a way of, you know, making those decisions and not just saying no. You know, you make decisions based on the implications of those decisions, their impact and, you know, functionality, you know, time and budget, basically. And so it, and though that's compelling, you know, that's it, you know, when I've done those things, made those sort of had those discussions, it's compelling for people, and so that you can, it allows you to make those decisions much easier. So
excellent. So we've gone really deep.
Yep.
And again, I want to start teaching this. I want to see it.
Yep.
It's a very immersive practice and very powerful. And also, it plays well with Agile and Lean and all these other approaches and processes. This is almost a documentation planning device. It doesn't take away from any other ways that the culture of the team is already operating.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that, you know, this is one thing I'm very interested in seeing, is how does this slot in? You know, I've done this for the hardware side, you know, and so I'm sort of happy to hear that it sort of looks, it sounds like that this can slot in pretty well. So, so that's sort of the sort of overview of the process. I'm very interested in getting people's feedback on this. So I know that we have the discussion on sort of the project management page. And then you can sort of comment there or just get in touch with us.
Great. Thank you so much, Malcolm, for our fifth discussion. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to keep going deeper into developing the Lean Spec process. Thank you for listening. This is available at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK, as well as at startupproduct.com.